Let's go off into the woods, man, YT says. I want to talk to you about what's going on with what's left of your brain. The woman smiles, struggles to her feet, with the good-natured awkwardness of a retarded person in a good mood.
I like to talk about that, she says, because I believe in it.
YT doesn't stop to do a lot of talking, just grabs the woman by the hand, starts leading her uphill into the scrubby little trees away from the road. She doesn't see any pink faces lurking up here in the infrared. It ought to be safe. But there are a couple behind her, just ambling along pleasantly, not looking directly at her, like they just decided it was time to go for a stroll in the woods in the middle of the night. One of them is the high priest. The woman's probably in her mid-twenties. She's a tall, gangly type, nice, but not good-looking. Probably was a spunky but low-scoring forward on her high school basketball team. YT sits her down on a rock out in the darkness. Do you have any idea where you are? YT says.
In the park, the woman says. With my friends. We're helping to spread the word.
How'd you get here?
From the Enterprise. That's where we go to learn things.
You mean like the raft? The Enterprise raft? Is that where you guys all came from?
I don't know where we came from, the woman says. Sometimes it's hard to remember stuff. But that's not important.
Where were you before? You didn't grow up on the raft, did you?
I was a systems programmer for Threeverse Systems in Mountain View, California, the woman says, suddenly whipping off a string of perfect, normal-sounding English.
Then how did you get to be on the raft?
I don't know. My old life stopped. My new life started. Now I'm here.
Back to baby talk. What's the last thing you remember before your old life stopped?
I was working late. My computer was having problems.
That's it? That's the last normal thing that happened to you?
My system crashed, she said. I saw static, and then I became very sick. I went to the hospital, and there in the hospital, I met a man who explained everything to me. He explained that I had been washed in the blood, and that I belonged to the Word now. And suddenly it all made sense. And then I decided to go to the raft.
You decided, or someone decided for you?
I just wanted to. That's where we go.
Who else was on the raft with you?
More people like me.
Like you how?
All programmers, like me, who had seen the Word.
Seen it on their computers?
Yes, or sometimes on TV.
What did you do on the raft?
The woman pushes up one sleeve of her raggedy sweatshirt to expose a needle-pocked arm.
You took drugs?
No, we gave blood.
They sucked your blood out?
Yes. Sometimes we would do a little coding, but only some of us.
How long have you been here?
I don't know. They move us here when our veins don't work anymore. We just do things to help spread the word. Drag stuff around, make barricades. But we don't really spend much time working. Most of the time, we sing songs, pray, and tell other people about the Word.
You want to leave? I can get you out of here.
No, the woman says. I've never been so happy.
How can you say that? You were a big-time hacker. Now you're kind of a dip, if I may speak frankly.
That's okay. It doesn't hurt my feelings. I wasn't really happy when I was a hacker. I never thought about the important things. God, heaven, the things of the spirit. It's hard to think about those things in America. You just put them aside. But those are really the important things. Not programming computers or making money. Now, that's all I think about.
YT has been keeping an eye on the high priest and his buddy. They keep moving closer, one step at a time.
Now they're close enough that YT can smell their dinner. The woman puts her hand on YT's shoulder pad.
I want you to stay here with me. Won't you come down and have some refreshments? You must be thirsty.
Gotta run, YT says, standing up.
I really have to object to that, the high priest says, stepping forward.
He doesn't say it angrily. Now he's trying to be like YT's dad.
That's not really the right decision for you.
What are you, a role model?
That's okay. You don't have to agree. But let's go down and sit by the campfire and talk about it.
Let's just get the fuck away from YT before she goes into a self-defense mode, YT says. All three Falabellas step back away from her. Very cooperative. The high priest is holding up his hands, placating her.
I'm sorry if we made you feel threatened, he says.
You guys just come on a little weird, YT says, flipping her goggles back onto infrared. In the infrared, she can see that the third Falabella, the one who came up here with the high priest, is holding a small thing in one hand that is unusually warm. She nails him with her penlight, spotlighting his upper body in a narrow yellow beam. Most of him is dirty and dun-colored and reflects little light. But there is a brilliant, glossy red thing, a shaft of ruby. It's a hypodermic needle. It's full of red fluid. Under infrared, it shows up warm. It's fresh blood. And she doesn't exactly get it. Why these guys would be walking around with a syringe full of fresh blood? But she's seen enough. The liquid knuckle shoots out of the can in a long, narrow, neon green stream, and when it nails the needle man in the face, he jerks his head back like he's just been axed across the bridge of the nose and falls back without making a sound. Then she gives the high priest a shot of it for good measure. The woman just stands there, totally, like, appalled. YT pumps herself up out of the canyon so fast that when she flies out into traffic, she's going about as fast as it is. As soon as she gets a solid poon on a nocturnal lettuce tanker, she gets on the phone to Mom. Mom, listen.
No, Mom, never mind the roaring noise.
Yes, I am riding my skateboard in traffic. But listen to me for a second, Mom. She has to hang up on the old bitch. It's impossible to talk to her. Then she tries to make a voice link up with Hero. That takes a couple of minutes to go through. Hello? 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 She's shouting. Then she hears the honk of a car horn coming out of the telephone.
Hello?
It's YT. How are you doing? This guy always seems a little too laid back in his personal dealings. She doesn't really want to talk about how she's doing. She hears another honking horn in the background, behind Hero's voice.
Where the hell are you, Hero?
Walking down a street in L.A.
How can you be goggled in if you're walking down a street?
Then the terrible reality sinks in.
Oh, my God. You didn't turn into a gargoyle, did you?
Well, Hero says.
He is hesitant, embarrassed, like it hadn't occurred to him yet that this is what he was doing.
It's not exactly like being a gargoyle. Remember when you gave me shit about spending all my money on computer stuff?
Yeah?
I decided I wasn't spending enough, so I got a belt pack machine, smallest ever made. I'm walking down the street with this thing strapped to my belly. It's really cool.
You're a gargoyle.
Yeah, but it's not like having all this clunky shit strapped all over your body.
You're a gargoyle. Listen, I talked to one of those wholesalers.
Yeah?
She says she used to be a hacker. She saw something strange on her computer. Then she got sick for a while and joined this cult and ended up on the raft.
The raft? Do tell.
On the Enterprise. They take their blood, Hero, suck it out of their bodies. They infect people by injecting them with the blood of sick hackers. And when their veins get all tracked out like a junkie's, they cut them loose and put them to work on the mainland running the wholesale operation.
That's good, he says. That's good stuff.
She says she saw some static on her computer screen, and it made her sick. You know anything about that?
Yeah, It's true.
It's true?
Yeah. But you don't have to worry about it. It only affects hackers.
For a minute, she can't even speak. She's so pissed.
My mother is a programmer for the feds. You asshole! Why didn't you warn me?
Half an hour later, she's there. Doesn't bother to change back into her wasp disguise this time. Just bursts into the house in basic bad black. Drops her plank on the floor on the way in. Grabs one of Mom's curios off the shelf. It's a heavy crystal award. Clear plastic, actually. That she got a couple of years ago for sucking up to her fed boss and passing all her polygraph tests, and goes into the den. Mom's there, as usual, working on her computer. But she's not looking at the screen right now. She's got some notes in her lap that she's going through. Just as Mom is looking up at her, YT winds up and throws the crystal award. It goes right over Mom's shoulder, glances off the computer table, flies right through the picture tube. Awesome results. YT always wanted to do that. She pauses to admire her work for a few seconds, while Mom just flames off all kinds of weird emotion. What are you doing in that uniform? Didn't I tell you not to ride your skateboard on a real street? You're not supposed to throw things in the house. That's my prized possession. Why did you break the computer? Government property. Just what is going on here anyway? YT can tell that this is going to continue for a couple of minutes. So she goes to the kitchen, splashes some water on her face, gets a glass of juice, just letting Mom follow her around and ventilate over her shoulder pads. Finally, Mom winds down, defeated by YT's strategy of silence. I just saved your fucking life, Mom, YT says. You could at least offer me an Oreo.
What on earth are you talking about? It's like if you people of a certain age would make some effort to just stay in touch with sort of basic modern-day events, then your kids wouldn't have to take these drastic measures.
'35. Earth materializes, rotating majestically in front of his face. Hero reaches out and grabs it. He twists it around so he's looking at Oregon. Tells it to get rid of the clouds, and it does, giving him a crystalline view of the mountains and the seashore. Right out there, a couple of hundred miles off the Oregon coast, is a sort of granulated furuncle growing on the face of the water. Festering is not too strong a word. It's a couple of hundred miles south of Astoria now, moving south, which explains why Juanita went to Astoria a couple of days ago. She wanted to get close to the raft. Why is anyone's guess. Hero looks up, focuses his gaze on Earth, zooms in for a look. As he gets closer, the imagery he's looking at shifts from the long-range pictures coming in from the geosynchronous satellites to the good stuff being spewed into the CIC computer from a whole fleet of low-flying spy birds. The view he's looking at is a mosaic of images shot no more than a few hours ago. It's several miles across. Its shape constantly changes, but at the time these pictures were shot, it had kind of a fat kidney shape. That is, it is trying to be a V, pointed southward like a flock of geese. But there's so much noise in the system, it's so amorphous and disorganized, that a kidney is the closest it can come. At the center is a pair of enormous vessels, the Enterprise and an oil tanker, lashed together side by side. These two behemoths are walled in by several other major vessels, an assortment of container ships and other freight carriers. The core. Everything else is pretty tiny. There is the occasional hijacked yacht or decommissioned fishing trawler, but most of the boats in the raft are just that. Boats. Small pleasure craft, sampans, junks, dhows, dinghies, life rafts, houseboats, makeshift structures built on air-filled oil drums and slabs of styrofoam. A good 50% of it isn't real boat material at all.
just a garble of ropes, cables, planks, nets, and other debris tied together on top of whatever kind of flotsam was handy. And L. Bob Reif is sitting in the middle of it. Hero doesn't quite know what he's doing, and he doesn't know how Juanita is connected. But it's time to go there and find out. Scott Lagerquist is standing right on the edge of Mark Norman's 24/7 motorcycle mall, waiting, when the man with the swords comes into view, striding down the sidewalk. A pedestrian is a peculiar sight in L.A., considerably more peculiar than the man with swords, but a welcome one. Anyone who drives out to a motorcycle dealership already has a car, by definition, so it's hard to give them a really hard sell. A pedestrian should be cake. "Scott Wilson Lagerquist," the guy yells from 50 feet away in closing. "How are you doing?" "Fabulous," Scott says. A little off guard, maybe. Can't remember this guy's name, which is a problem. Where has he seen this guy before? "It's great to see you," Scott says, running forward and pumping the guy's hand. "I haven't seen you since,
Is Pinky here today?" the guy says.
"Pinky?"
"Yeah, Mark. Mark Norman. Pinky was his nickname back in college. I guess he probably doesn't like to be called that now that he's running, what, half a dozen dealerships, 3 McDonald'ses, and a Holiday Inn, huh?"
"I didn't know that Mr. Norman was into fast food also."
"Yeah, he's got 3 franchises down around Long Beach. Owns them through a limited partnership, actually. Is he here today?"
"No, he's on vacation."
"Oh, yeah, in Corsica, the Ayacho Hyatt. Room 543. That's right. I completely forgot about that."
"Well, were you just stopping by to say hi, or..."
"Nah, I was going to buy a motorcycle."
"Oh, what kind of motorcycle were you looking for?"
"One of the new Yamahas, with the new generation smart wheels." Scott grins manfully, trying to put the best face on the awful fact that he's about to reveal.
"I know exactly the one you mean, but I'm sorry to tell you that we don't actually have one in stock today."
"You don't?"
"We don't. It's a brand new model. Nobody has them."
"You sure?" "Because you ordered one."
"We did?"
"Yeah, a month ago."
Suddenly the guy cranes his neck, looks over Scott's shoulder down the boulevard.
"Well, speak of the devil. Here it comes."
A Yamaha semi is pulling into the truck entrance with a new shipment of motorcycles in the back.
"It's on that truck," the guy says. "If you can give me one of your cards, I'll jot down the vehicle identification number on back so you can pull it off the truck for me."
"This was a special order made by Mr. Norman?"
"He claimed he was just ordering it as a display model, you know. But it sort of has my name on it."
"Yes, sir. I understand totally."
Sure enough, the bike comes off the truck, just as the guy described it, right down to color scheme, black, and vehicle ID number. It's a beautiful bike. It draws a crowd, just sitting on the parking lot. The other salesmen actually put down their coffee cups and take their feet off their desks to go outside and look at it. It looks like a black land torpedo. Two-wheel drive, Natch. The wheels are so advanced, they're not even wheels. They look like giant, heavy-duty versions of the smart wheels that high-speed skateboards use. Independently telescoping spokes with fat traction pads on the ends. Dangling out over the front, in the nose cone of the motorcycle, is the sensor package that monitors road conditions, decides where to place each spoke as it rolls forward, how much to extend it, and how to rotate the footpad for maximum traction. It's all controlled by a BIOS, a built-in operating system, an onboard computer with a flat panel screen built into the top of the fuel tank. They say that this baby will do 120 miles per hour on rubble. The BIOS patches itself into the CIC weather net so that it knows when it's about to run into precip. The aerodynamic cowling is totally flexible, calculates its own most efficient shape for the current speed and wind conditions,
changes its curves accordingly, wraps around you like a nymphomaniacal gymnast. Scott figures this guy is going to waltz off with his thing for dealer invoice, being a friend and confidant of Mr. Norman. And it's not an easy thing for any red-blooded salesman to write out a contract to sell a sexy beast like this one at dealer invoice. He hesitates for a minute, wonders what's going to happen to him if this is all some kind of mistake. The guy's watching him intently, seems to sense his nervousness, almost as if he can hear Scott's heart beating. So at the last minute, he eases up, gets magnanimous. Scott loves these big spender types. Decides to throw in a few hundred Kong bucks over invoice, just so Scott can pull in a meager commission on the deal. A tip, basically. Then, icing on the cake. The guy goes nuts in the cycle shop, totally berserk. Buys a complete outfit, everything, top of the line. A full black coverall that swaddles everything from toes to neck in breathable, bulletproof fabric with armor gel pads in all the right places and airbags around the neck. Even safety fanatics don't bother with a helmet when they're wearing one of these babies. So once he's figured out how to attach his swords on the outside of his coverall, he's on his way. I gotta say this, Scott says as the guy is sitting on his new bike, getting his swords adjusted, doing something incredibly unauthorized to the BIOS. You look like one bad motherfucker.
Thanks, I guess.
He twists the throttle up once, and Scott feels but does not hear the power of the engine. This baby is so efficient, it doesn't waste power by making noise.
Say hi to your brand new niece, the guy says, and then lets go the clutch.
The spokes flex and gather themselves, and the bike springs forward out of the lot, seeming to jump off its electric paws. He cuts right across the parking lot of the neighboring Neo-Aquarian Temple franchise and pulls out onto the road. About half a second later, the guy with the swords is a dot on the horizon. Then he's gone. Northbound.
'36.
Until a man is 25, he still thinks every so often that under the right circumstances, he could be the baddest motherfucker in the world. If I moved to a martial arts monastery in China and studied real hard for 10 years. If my family was wiped out by Colombian drug dealers and I swore myself to revenge. If I got a fatal disease, had 1 year to live, devoted it to wiping out street crime. If I just dropped out and devoted my life to being bad. Hero used to feel that way too, but then he ran into Raven. In a way, this is liberating. He no longer has to worry about trying to be the baddest motherfucker in the world. The position is taken. The crowning touch, the one thing that really puts true world-class bad motherfuckerdom totally out of reach, of course, is the hydrogen bomb. If it wasn't for the hydrogen bomb, a man could still aspire. Maybe find Raven's Achilles heel. Sneak up, get a drop, slip a Mickey, pull a fast one. But Raven's nuclear umbrella kinda puts the world title out of reach. Which is okay. Sometimes it's all right just to be a little bad. To know your limitations. Make do with what you've got. Once he maneuvers his way onto the freeway, aimed up into the mountains, he goggles into his office. Earth is still there, zoomed in tight on the raft. Hero contemplates it, superimposed in ghostly hues on his view of the highway as he rides toward Oregon at 140 miles per hour. From a distance, it looks bigger than it really is. Getting closer, he can see that this illusion is caused by an enveloping self-made slick-slash-cloud of sewage and air pollution fading out into the ocean and the atmosphere. It orbits the Pacific clockwise. When they fire up the boilers on the Enterprise, it can control its direction a little bit. But real navigation is a practical impossibility with all the other shit lashed onto it. It mostly has to go where the wind and the Coriolis effect take it. A couple of years ago, it was going by the Philippines, Vietnam, China, Siberia, picking up refuse. Then it swung up the Aleutian chain, down the Alaska Panhandle, and now it's gliding past the small town of Port Sherman, Oregon, near the California border. As the raft moves through the Pacific, riding mostly on ocean currents, it occasionally sheds great hunks of itself. Eventually, these fragments wash up in some place like Santa Barbara, still lashed together, carrying a payload of skeletons and gnawed bones. When it gets to California, it will enter a new phase of its life cycle. It will shed much of its sprawling, improvised bulk as a few hundred thousand refuse cut themselves loose and paddle to shore. The only refuse who make it that far are, by definition, the ones who were agile enough to make it out to the raft in the first place, resourceful enough to survive the agonizingly slow passage through the Arctic waters, and tough enough not to get killed by any of the other refuse. Nice guys, all of them. Just the kind of people you'd like to have showing up on your private beach in groups of a few thousand. Stripped down to a few major ships, a little more maneuverable, the Enterprise then will swing across the South Pacific, heading for Indonesia, where it will turn north again and start the next cycle of migration. Army ants cross mighty rivers by climbing on top of each other and clustering together into a little ball that floats. Many of them fall off and sink, and naturally the ants in the bottom of the ball drown. The ones who are quick and vigorous enough to keep clawing their way to the top survive. A lot of them make it across, and that's why you can't stop army ants by dynamiting the bridges. That's how refuse come across the Pacific. Even though they are too poor to book passage on a real ship or buy a seaworthy boat, a new wave washes up onto the West Coast every 5 years or so, when the ocean currents bring the Enterprise back. For the last couple of months, owners of beachfront property in California have been hiring security people, putting up spotlights and anti-personnel fences along the tide line, mounting machine guns on their yachts. They have all subscribed to CIC's 24-hour raft report, getting the latest news flash straight from the satellite on when the latest contingent of 25,000 starving Eurasians has cut itself loose from the Enterprise and started dipping its myriad oars into the Pacific like ant legs. "Time to do more digging," he tells the librarian. "But this is going to have to be totally verbal, because I'm heading up I-5 at some incredible speed right now, and I have to watch out for slow-moving bagos and stuff."
"I'll keep that in mind," the voice of the librarian says into his earphones. "Look out for the jackknife truck south of Santa Clarita, and there is a large chuck hole in the left lane near the two-layer exit."
"Thanks. Who are these gods, anyway? Did Lagos have an opinion on that?"
"Lagos believed that they might have been magicians, that is, normal human beings with special powers, or they might have been aliens."
Whoa, hold on. Let's take these one at a time. What did Lagos mean when he talked about normal human beings with special powers?
Assume that the Namshub of Enki really functioned as a virus. Assume that someone named Enki invented it. Then Enki must have had some kind of linguistic power that goes beyond our concept of normal.
And how would this power work? What's the mechanism?
I can only give you forward references drawn by Lagos.
Okay, give me some.
The belief in the magical power of language is not unusual, both in mystical and academic literature. The Kabbalists, Jewish mystics of Spain and Palestine, believed that supernormal insight and power could be derived from properly combining the letters of the divine name. For example, Abu Aharon, an early Kabbalist who emigrated from Baghdad to Italy, was said to perform miracles through the power of the sacred names.
What kind of power are we talking about here?
Most Kabbalists were theorists who were interested only in pure meditation. But there were so-called practical Kabbalists who tried to apply the power of the Kabbalah in everyday life.
In other words, sorcerers.
Yes. These practical Kabbalists used a so-called archangelic alphabet, derived from 1st century Greek and Aramaic theurgic alphabets, which resembled cuneiform. The Kabbalists referred to this alphabet as I-writing, because the letters were composed of lines and small circles which resembled eyes, ones and zeros. Some Kabbalists divided up the letters of the alphabet according to where they were produced inside the mouth. Okay, so as we would think of it, they were drawing a connection between the printed letter on the page and the neural connections that had to be invoked in order to pronounce it. Yes, by analyzing the spelling of various words, they were able to draw what they thought were profound conclusions about their true inner meaning and significance.
Okay, if you say so.
In the academic realm, the literature is naturally not as fanciful. But a great deal of effort has been devoted to explaining Babel. Not the Babel event, which most people consider to be a myth, but the fact that languages tend to diverge. A number of linguistic theories have been developed in an effort to tie all languages together.
Theories Lagos tried to apply to his virus hypothesis.
Yes, there are two schools, relativists and universalists. As George Steiner summarizes it, relativists tend to believe that language is not the vehicle of thought, but its determining medium. It is the framework of cognition. Our perceptions of everything are organized by the flux of sensations passing over that framework. Hence, the study of the evolution of language is the study of the evolution of the human mind itself.
Okay, I could see the significance of that. What about the universalists?
In contrast with the relativists, who believe that languages need not have anything in common with each other, the universalists believe that if you can analyze languages enough, you can find that all of them have certain traits in common. So they analyze languages looking for such traits.
Have they found any?
No. There seems to be an exception to every rule,
which blows universalism out of the water.
Not necessarily. They explain this problem by saying that the shared traits are too deeply buried to be analyzable.
Which is a cop-out.
Their point is that at some level, language has to happen inside the human brain, since all human brains are more or less the same.
The hardware's the same, not the software.
You are using some kind of metaphor that I cannot understand.
Hero whips past a big airstream that is rocking from side to side in a dangerous wind coming down the valley.
Well, a French speaker's brain starts out the same as an English speaker's brain. As they grow up, they get programmed with different software. They learn different languages.
Yes. Therefore, according to the universalists, French and English, or any other languages, must share certain traits that have their roots in the deep structures of the human brain. According to Chomskyan theory, the deep structures are innate components of the brain that enable it to carry out certain formal kinds of operations on strings of symbols. Or, as Steiner paraphrases Emin Bach, these deep structures eventually lead to the actual patterning of the cortex with its immensely ramified, yet at the same time programmed network of electrochemical and neurophysiological channels.
But these deep structures are so deep we can't even see them?
The universalists place the active nodes of linguistic life, the deep structures, so deep as to defy observation and description. Or to use Steiner's analogy, try to draw up the creature from the depths of the sea, and it will disintegrate or change form grotesquely.
There's that serpent again.
So which theory did Lagos believe in? The relativist or the universalist? He did not seem to think there was much of a difference. In the end, they are both somewhat mystical. Lagos believed that both schools of thought had essentially arrived at the same place by different lines of reasoning.
But it seems to me there is a key difference, Hero says.
The universalists think that we are determined by the pre-patterned structure of our brains, the pathways in the cortex. The relativists don't believe that we have any limits.
Lagos modified the strict Chomskyan theory by supposing that learning a language is like blowing code into proms, an analogy that I cannot interpret.
The analogy is clear. Proms are programmable read-only memory chips, Hero says. When they come from the factory, they have no content. Once and only once, you can place information into those chips and then freeze it. The information, the software, becomes frozen into the chip. It transmutes into hardware. After you have blown the code into the proms, you can read it out, but you can't write to them anymore. So Lagos was trying to say that the newborn human brain has no structure, as the relativists would have it, and that as the child learns a language, the developing brain structures itself accordingly. The language gets blown into the hardware and becomes a permanent part of the brain's deep structure, as the universalists would have it.
Yes, this was his interpretation.
Okay. So when he talked about Enki being a real person with magical powers, what he meant was that Enki somehow understood the connection between language and the brain, knew how to manipulate it. The same way that a hacker, knowing the secrets of a computer system, can write code to control it. Digital namshubs.
Lagos said that Enki had the ability to ascend into the universe of language and see it before his eyes, much as humans go into the metaverse. That gave him power to create namshubs. And namshubs had the power to alter the functioning of the brain and of the body.
Why isn't anyone doing this kind of thing nowadays? Why aren't there any namshubs in English?
Not all languages are the same, as Steiner points out. Some languages are better at metaphor than others. Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek and Chinese lend themselves to wordplay and have achieved a lasting grip on reality. Palestine had Kiryat Sefer, the city of the letter, and Syria had Byblos, the town of the book. By contrast, other civilizations seem speechless, or at least, as may have been the case in Egypt, not entirely cognizant of the creative and transformational powers of language. Lagos believed that Sumerian was an extraordinarily powerful language. At least it was in Sumer 5,000 years ago. A language that lent itself to Enki's neurolinguistic hacking. Early linguists, as well as the Kabbalists, believed in a fictional language called the Tongue of Eden, the language of Adam. It enabled all men to understand each other, to communicate without misunderstanding. It was the language of the Logos, the moment when God created the world by speaking a word. In the Tongue of Eden, naming a thing was the same as creating it. To quote Steiner again, quote, "Our speech interposes itself between apprehension and truth like a dusty pane or warped mirror. The Tongue of Eden was like a flawless glass. A light of total understanding streamed through it. Thus Babel was a second fall." And Isaac the Blind, an early Kabbalist, said that, to quote Gershom Scholem's translation, "The speech of men is connected with divine speech, and all language, whether heavenly or human, derives from one source, the divine name." End quote. The practical Kabbalists, the sorcerers, bore the title Baal Shem, meaning master of the divine name.
The machine language of the world, Hero says.
Is this another analogy?
Computers speak machine language, Hero says. It's written in ones and zeros, binary code. At the lowest level, all computers are programmed with strings of ones and zeros. When you program in machine language, you are controlling the computer at its brainstem, the root of its existence. It's the Tongue of Eden. But it's very difficult to work in machine language because you go crazy after a while, working at such a minute level. So a whole babble of computer languages has been created for programmers. Fortran, Basic, COBOL, Lisp, Pascal, C, Prolog, Forth. You talk to the computer in one of these languages, and a piece of software called a compiler converts it into machine language.
But you never can tell exactly what the compiler is doing. It doesn't always come out the way you want, like a dusty pane or warped mirror. A really advanced hacker comes to understand the true inner workings of the machine. He sees through the language he's working in and glimpses the secret functioning of the binary code. Becomes a Baal Shem of sorts. Lagos believed that the legends about the Tongue of Eden were exaggerated versions of true events, the librarian says. These legends reflect a nostalgia for a time when people spoke Sumerian, a tongue that was superior to anything that came afterward.
Is Sumerian really that good?
Not as far as modern-day linguists can tell, the librarian says. As I mentioned, it is largely impossible for us to grasp. Lago suspected that words worked differently in those days. If one's native tongue influences the physical structure of the developing brain, then it is fair to say that the Sumerians, who spoke a language radically different from anything in existence today, had fundamentally different brains from yours. Lagos believed that for this reason, Sumerian was a language ideally suited to the creation and propagation of viruses. That a virus, once released into Sumer, would spread rapidly and virulently until it had infected everyone.
Maybe Enki knew that also, Hero says. Maybe the Namshub of Enki wasn't such a bad thing. Maybe Babel was the best thing that ever happened to us.